Good morning, everyone, and thank you to those of you who have your cameras on. Those of you who don't, if you feel comfortable turning them on, that would be appreciated. Thank you. And we'll get started.
Yes. Okay. Ready. So welcome. So this is my third lecture, and today my purpose is to discuss the properties of the propagator that we have computed using functional integral yesterday, which is an object that you know already, at least in the Minkowskian, so real-time setting, because you studied it in QFT1 and QFT2. And I'm going then to introduce a bit more advanced material, which deals with how to define more complicated operators, which are powers or derivatives of the fields, which are called composite operators. And we'll see that the real feature of a quantum field theory, namely the fact that it has a short distance or high energy singular behavior, very different from classical mechanics, classical field theory, or non-relativistic quantum mechanics, appears and plays a very important role. So I'm going to discuss also the structure of the short distance, what's called ultraviolet behavior of the propagator, and also a bit of its infrared, so large distance behavior. And this will lead next time to discuss, introduce something you have seen already in the canonical formalism setting, which is constructing in perturbation theory and an interacting theory. In this case, this is going to be the Phi-4 interacting theory for a scalar field. Okay, but this will start probably on Monday. Okay, so let me start again to remember that we consider the free scalar field. So we consider the free scalar field. So the dynamical object or the dynamical field, quantum field in the quantum theory, is an object which is phi. So it's either a classical field or a quantum operator, local operator, depending on space-time. And in the Euclidean setting, x is just x0 and x, while in a Minkowskian setting, namely, when the space has a Lorentz signature, x is time, and space, and the relation between Euclidean time and real time, remember, is that t is minus I x naught. That's the recipe of the Vick rotation. Okay, so we have seen yesterday that when you compute using functional integral the propagator, so the propagator is just defined as a vacuum expectation value of the products of two fields. So it's denoted I of x, I of y, if you have two points, x and y. And this is an object that I call denoted g0 of x. By translational invariance, it depends only on the vector x minus y. And we have seen that in the Euclidean setting, in fact, this object, the Euclidean propagator is just given by the Fourier transform of a Lorentzian function. So this is integral dk over 2 pi to the power d of ei k dot x divided by k squared plus m squared, where k is a conjugate momentum in the sense of a Fourier transform of X. So this is some K0, but with lower indices. And so it's a, given by K mu, so it's a K0 and some K vector. Okay, and that's important. So that's the scalar products of X given by this and K is just it's mu K mu. Namely, this is X0 times K0 plus X times K. Okay, and in the Minkowskian setting, K is still denoted by K mu, and this is now some frequency, omega and K, but still, this is valid both in the Minkowskian Euclidean setting and in the Minkowskian setting, because that's a vector, and that's a covector. So X is defined by X with a pointer. So this is valid both here and here. Okay, so that's my my notation, which differs slightly from notation of other textbooks. Okay. And but of course, what's different is what is K squared, because K squared in the Euclidean setting, in Euclidean setting is K0 squared plus K squared in the Euclidean setting. While in Minkowski, K squared is minus K0 squared, minus, let's say, omega squared, the frequency, plus K squared. Because with my notation, the signature of the metric, for instance, in four dimension is plus, plus, plus for Euclidean space, of course, but for Minkowski, this is minus plus plus plus, which is okay. Okay, so in Euclidean setting, this is a value, and in Minkowski space, this is the corresponding object by making this weak rotation, and so and by the same receipt, weak rotation. The relation between omega, the frequency in Minkowski spacetime, is I K0. That's because this is a vector, this is a covector, so the weak rotation acts with the opposite sign for a vector and for a covector. Okay. So now, so this is just reminder from last lecture, and we have seen at the end of that lecture that we recover that in Minkowski space, what we recover in Minkowski is the Feynman propagator. Let's go, well, of course here, this is g of x minus y. We get the Feynman propagator, which corresponds to the vacuum expectation value of the time order product of I of x, I of y. Feynman. With a causal ordering of the operators, of the field operator. Okay. So now I'm going to discuss how this object behaves in space and in space-time. So in the Euclidean setting, well, of course, this the symmetry of Euclidean space is invariant by Euclidean transformation, so translation. This is why this depends only on x minus y. To a translation plus rotations. So of course, this Euclidean propagator is just a function G naught of the modulus. So the square of x minus y. Well, of course, x squared is just x zero squared plus x squared. Okay, so it's just a function of the distance between the two points. Okay, and you can check that this this function as a Fourier transform is an object which is well defined. Well, in fact, you can compute it. And if you are, I think I have the notes here. I just have to check. This is some Bessel function. This is a Bessel function. And you can find the expression of the Bessel function in the law, in the lecture notes of last year's. Okay, so it's known. And one important point is that you see that here you have a mask, you have a length scale because you have the mass. So it's a function of x minus y times the mass, where m is the mass of the boson, because this is dimensionless. So it has to be a function. Okay. And the exact expression, well, you can find it in the lecture notes, and I'm going to discuss that a bit later. But what we are interested in what's happening at short distances. Because you see that if x minus y, you make it zero, you get an integral of a form dd of k divided by k squared plus m squared. And when x minus y is equal to zero, you have no oscillating factor in the Fourier transform integral. And therefore, you see that when x equals y, this integral is divergent. This is infinite. As long as the dimension here is larger than 2. You see, because the numerator behaves like a momentum to the power k, while the denominator behaves like a momentum to the power minus 2. So if you integrate over an angular variable, for instance, you end up with an integral which is something like dk, k d minus 1 divided by k squared as k goes to infinity. You integrate from 0 to infinity. and you get a divergent integral. So you see that the propagator is not well-defined at short distance. This is called the problem of ultraviolet singularities, which is the basics of the problem with which requires renormalization. Okay, so. Well, you can work a bit more and compute exactly the propagator in two dimension, in three dimension, in four dimension. This is given by some integral. Yes. Mm-hmm.
But when we say short distances, do we mean x minus y is small or k is large, or are they? Means both of them could be different things, right?
No, that's the same thing. Because, well, you see here that when x equal y, the integral is divergent.
Yeah.
The divergence occurs for large k.
Mm-hmm. See? Yeah, yeah, yeah. But
so now, if you want to analyze the system, what's happening when k, when x is small, you see when x is small, this is an oscillating factor. And what's important is what's happening when k is of order of x minus y, of 1 over x minus y. So in fact, so when x minus y is small, and in fact, it's much smaller than 1 over the mass, because in fact, this is a dimensionless quantity, then what dominates in the Fourier transform integral are the k such that the k are of order of 1 over x minus y. So you have to analyze this behavior. Okay. And well, your question is a very good question, because it, you see that when k is of order of 1 over x minus y, and when x minus y is much smaller than 1 over m, then k squared is much larger than m squared. So you can forget about the mass term. And you can forget about the mass in the integral, and replace this integral, so the propagator g naught, well, let's call it just g naught of x. So x is going to be the difference between x and y. It behaves, it's, you can approximate it by integral d dk over 2 pi to the power d, e I k dot x divided by k squared. You see? And now do just a bit of dimensional analysis. X has a dimension of a distance. It's a length. It's a distance between points. K is its conjugate quantity, so it's the inverse of a distance. Okay, so what is the dimension of this object? This dimension of this object is a distance to the power minus d times some number times a distance to power 2. So basically, this has the dimension of a distance to the power 2 minus d. And the only distance we have available in this integral is just x. So this is x to the power 2 minus the dimension of spacetime. You see? With some number here, some coefficient. Okay, well, you can compute the coefficient. It's not very difficult. Do a bit of calculation. But the important point is this power of the distance between the two points to the power 2 minus d. And that's just dimensional analysis. So it's an analysis free space just of dimensional analysis. Okay. And you see immediately that if the dimension of space time is one, and this is the case just of you just have one time and no space as a variable in which a field lives. So this is ordinary quantum mechanics. Then this is two minus one. So this is there are no singularities when x goes to zero. So in ordinary quantum mechanics, no ultraviolet singularities. But when d is equal to two, this is a power zero. But it turns out, in fact, that this coefficient, you can find that it is some number times two minus d. So formally, if you let d goes to zero, you get a log. You see? So in, this behaves like a log of x when d equal two. When d equal to three, this behaves like x minus one. When d equal four, this behaves like x to the power minus two, etc. Okay, so this is a simple analysis of the short distance singularities of the propagator based just on dimensional analysis. Okay. So, and that's a very important difference between quantum theory in Minkowski spacetime on Euclidean spacetime. Here we are in Euclidean spacetime. Ordinary quantum mechanics, non-relativistic quantum mechanics, where you have just one x zero, which is a time, and you just have to solve Schrödinger equation. Okay, so now let's go back to okay. So now. Well, the other limit that we may consider is what's happening at large distance. So at large distance. So when x minus y is much larger than 1 over m. OK? Well, in this case, you can analyze this thing, this this integral. You know that here you have k squared plus m squared. So basically, you have a residue when k is equal to plus or minus im. And it's easy to see from this analysis that g0 of x. Let me just erase and show this clearly. G0 of x behave in this large distance regime as exponential minus the mass times the distance, the norm of the, which means that the propagator as exponential decay. And that's often denoted as the existence of a mass gap. Okay. And that's because M is the mass of the boson, and we are studying a theory of massive bosons. So there is a gap in the spectrum because the vacuum state, which has energy zero, and the first excited state, which is a state with one boson in space-time, which has energy equal to m, since mc2, but c0 holds this formalism. Remember that we have in the situation where we have normalized the speed of light to be one. Remember, C. Okay. So, so this is a result for the Euclidean symmetry, the Euclidean propagator. So I can show that, well, let me show just the Euclidean propagator. 1 plus 1 dimension, where in fact we have a log. Well, this is x0, this is x1. So this is Euclidean space-time, this is space. We are just in a one-dimensional space, and you just have a singularity at the origin. Let's see. And elsewhere, the propagator is a well-defined function. So here you have the ultraviolet singularity. Okay, so now, so this is the Euclidean setting. What do you get in Minkowski space-time? Then you are considering the Feynman propagator. You can study just by making this weak rotation in K, turn the crank, and what you get is the causal structure of the Feynman propagator that you have studied in QFT. So now in Minkowski space-time, here you have time. Remember, time is the first component of space-time vectors. Here you have x. I'm still in 1 plus 1 dimension for simplicity. Okay, and then you have two kinds of singularity in the Feynman propagator. Well, first, you know that you have causal singularity along the light cone. You have the light cone. Okay, so this is a future light cone. This is the past. And where the space-time vectors are time-like. And this is the region where the space-time vectors are space-like. Okay. And it turns out that in this region, the propagator is well defined because basically, since x is space-like, you can use Lorentz invariance to get that the vector is just a pure space vector. And here you can use the formula of the propagator in Euclidean space-time because there is no difference. So in space-like, this is like Euclidean. So you have only a singularity here at the origin. Okay. So now, inside the future light cone and inside the past light cone, the Feynman propagator gets imaginary part. And that's a reflect of causality. So in fact, here you have some causal discontinuity. Okay. So the discontinuity or the singularities of the Feynman propagator are of two kinds. You have the causal singularity here along the light cone, but they are under control because of the causality properties of the quantum field theory. And but still here, you have the same short distance or ultraviolet singularity. And that's the same singularity that you had is Euclidean theory. So it's a global structure of the theory. It's irrespective of whether you work in Euclidean space-time or in Minkowski space-time. This ultraviolet singularity is a generic feature of the theory. Okay?
In more detail, in what sense they're under control?
Yes.
Could you just explain in a bit more detail in what sense they're under control? Is this automatic ordering?
I can explain this in a bit more. I'm going to give you a mathematical description of the kind of singularity we have. If I have a bit of time, but I need to make some a bit elaborate picture. I don't think this picture in the blackboard, but in the notes, but I don't want to spend too much time, so I will just draw you a picture and then get convinced of what the picture means. Okay. So I'm going to represent Euclidean space. No, I'm going to represent here. I work in a three-dimensional space where here is time. Here is Euclidean space-time. So the plane of my blackboard is complex. Time. This is a blackboard. Plane. That's a complex plane of complex time. But now I imagine that I live in three dimension, and my third dimension here is real space. So let me represent real space as something like that. Okay. So I'm just representing a 3D perspective, and I have X1, which is real space. Okay. So what I'm representing now is a complex plane times R for time and space. I am of course in 1+1 dimension for simplicity. If you understand what's going on in one dimension, you understand what's going on. Okay. So now my Minkowski space-time, this is a plane. This is the horizontal plane. So I can represent it like that. Minkowski space-time as okay, so you see. This is my Minkowski plane, okay? And what is Euclidean spacetime? That's the plane spanned by Euclidean time and space. So this is a vertical plane going like that. So here I represent, let me represent it with a slightly different color, blue color. You see, this is Euclidean space, the Euclidean plane. So you have a plane, and this, what I'm going to draw here is something which is behind this is behind the Euclidean plane. Okay, is it clear? So we have the Euclidean plane here, the Minkowski plane here, and the cross just along the real space line. Okay, so in the Euclidean plane, you just have a singularity here. In the Minkowski plane, you have the light cone. Of course, this light cone here is behind plane. No, that's below. And here is below, and here. So here, in this three-dimensional plane, you have a cut here. The light cone is just a discontinuity. So imagine that you have some kind of double fan, you know, in this plane and in this plane. And if you start from the Euclidean plane somewhere, you can reach the light cone here, either from below or from above. And you just get different results. So basically what you have is that you have the light cone here, is that you have a discontinuity here. You have a discontinuity here. This is the origin. And starting from the Euclidean space-time, either you go this way or you get out. So this is just a discontinuity. You have a domain of analyticity in a complex plane, which it's a singularity. You cannot make a sensible analytic continuation when you reach the physical real-time line. So this discontinuity is a discontinuity associated to causality. And the relation you have between the value of the propagator here and the value of the propagator above is related to the causal structure of the theory. For instance, in fact, that's an exercise, but you can check that the value of the discontinuity, so the value of G Feynman below minus G Feynman above, is just here, is just the advanced propagator, if you are here. So the discontinuity along this, you know, this cone is just the advanced propagator, while the discontinuity along the past light cone is a retard propagator. So in this sense, the discontinuity, the singularity here is associated to the fact that you have causality discontinuity, and the relation between the value of the discontinuity is given by the causal structure of the theory. Okay? I just a picture to explain what's going on, but I find it very useful.
That was very useful indeed.
What? Pardon?
Very useful indeed. Good picture, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. But I'm not very good at drawing. Well, I should may put it in the way. Okay, so now I want to go back to some physics. And I see now, where does this singularity comes from? So this singularity comes from the fact, in fact, the fact that the propagator at x equal y is not well defined means that when you consider the expectation value of phi at some point and at some other point. And when you let x goes to y, where you expect, you would expect to get just the expectation value of the phi, the operator phi squared of x at a given point, you find that this is well defined. But this is infinite. So you see the operator phi and products of operator phi of fields operator, quantum operators at different points in space-time are well defined. But if you try to compute the products of them at the same point, this is infinite because of the ultraviolet singularity. And that's very different from the case of quantum mechanics. Because in quantum mechanics, you can consider the operator Q at the time T1 times Q at the time T2. And in when T1 goes to T2, I'm in the Heisenberg picture. I get the operator Q squared of T, which is a well-defined operator in quantum mechanics. It's just, for instance, the potential of an harmonic oscillator. So in quantum mechanics, this is finite. In a quantum field theory, this object is well defined. So the intrinsic object phi squared is not well defined, and it's not well defined in the functional integral itself. So how can one see that? Well, there is a simple way to see that, which is to start from the functional integral in Euclidean spacetime and view it as integration of a configuration of space with some measure and view this measure as a probability measure. So view exponential of minus the Euclidean action of S of phi as a probability measure. A probability which assigns to any, you know, sample of fields phi of x a probability. Okay, and then you may ask a question that scientists and mathematicians and both mathematicians and physicists and any other field ask when they deal with statistics of object and probabilities. They say, what is the typical, what are the typical property of a sample in this probability space? So you pick up with the right probability a sample in your probability space and you look at what it is. And that's, this can be done I'm just going to show you some picture, and those are picture which are which can be done, which are in the lecture notes, but I'm going to try to see you. So let me try. I'd like to share a screen. Dan, you are the organizer. Can you, give me the right to share a screen. Dan?
I know.
Okay. Just me. Okay, good. So now, yes. Okay, so now instead of seeing me, you should see some, okay, I should have a, I just have to activate a diaporama. Yes, here it is. Okay, so I'm going to show what is called a typical configuration of what's mathematician called the Gaussian free field, which is a configuration in the functional integral of a scalar-free field using the action of the scalar-free field. Well, for simplicity, in the case where the field is massless, so the M is zero, but that's not complicated to do it otherwise. Okay, so let me go on. Okay, so this is what you are seeing here. Is it clear? Do you see clearly? Is that you see a typical configuration of the field in the functional integral in 1 + 1 dimension. And I have discretized space-time. So I have replaced, as explained in the first lecture, space-time by a lattice. And here the lattice is, well, I can't read what is, but I think it's, well, I'm sure.
It's a 64×64.
Yeah, 64×64. No, I don't have all the pictures in my lecture notes. Yeah, so it's 64×64. So it's a pretty small lattice for physicists and mathematicians doing numerical simulations. And so you see the horizontal axis are just x1 and x0 and x1, so Euclidean time and space. And the vertical axis is just the value of the field. So you know, the height of this surface, random surface, is the value of the field. So if it's a tip, the field is very has positive value. If it's a pit down, on the it's the field has negative value. And you see that it's an object that fluctuates. It fluctuates in both directions. Now, the question is that, so the point is that this is a typical configuration on a finite lattice. So since we are on a finite lattice, we are not discussing what's happening at short distance. So now let's go take a finer lattice. So the lattice is supposed to have the same size, but the mesh is smaller. So now the mesh is twice smaller. And what you see is that the configuration of the field is more spiky. Repeat, it becomes very, very spiky. And here it should be, can you read what I, for some reason I can't read because it's hidden, but that's it must be, 4, 8 times more. It's very, it's, very spiky.
Yeah, it's 5×12×5×12.
You see, okay. And I think that, okay, so that's, okay. So, and basically, so if you go further and further, the a typical sampling of the field in the functional integral becomes infinitely spiky. Okay, so infinitely spiky means that basically it's plus or minus infinity everywhere. And it's somehow at random, but not completely at random. It's not a white noise. It's the Gaussian free field whose correlation function is given by this propagator. And this means that in fact, well, mathematicians have a well-defined way to make sense of this. This means that the free field is a random distribution. It's not a function, but it's a distribution in the sense of mathematician. You know the simplest example of distribution that every theoretical physicist knows is a Dirac distribution, which is a function which is smooth everywhere, except at the origin where it's infinite, but one can make sense of it. So in some sense, this is a very peculiar infinite sum of delta functions, but the delta functions are correlated. If they were not correlated at a different point of space-time, it would be just two-dimensional white noise. But it's not white noise. It's the object that mathematicians call the Gaussian free field. Okay, so this is in 1 + 1 dimension, where we have seen that the singularity is logarithmic. Now, repeat the same operation in 3 dimension. Of course, in 3 dimension, it's more difficult to represent. So I've just represented here a two-dimensional section of a sample of a three-dimensional free field. Again, on a small lattice where it's spiky. I refine the mesh, it's more spiky. It's even more spiky. And well, if you pay a bit of attention, you can realize that it's more spiky. So it's also a distribution, but it's a wider distribution than in 2 dimensions. And this is a consequence of the fact that the singularity here is like 1 over the distance instead of the logarithm of the distance. So the and of course you can repeat it in you can go further in 4 dimensions and go on, and you realize that it's always the Gaussian free field is often is always a random distribution, but the correlation between the value of the field, the value of the distribution, is more and more singular, more and more irregular as the dimension of space-time occurs. So you must keep this picture, the object in the functional integral for the scalar field are not random histories or random functions, but they are distributions. So they are not continuous. This is not continuous. Okay.
Are you just saying discretization because of actually running the simulation, or would you still get this distribution if you took the continuum limit?
Well, if you took the I couldn't represent the distribution in the continuum limit because it would be an object which is, as I said, everywhere, in the sense of mathematician, except on a zero measure set of points, the value of the Gaussian free field will be plus or minus infinity. Well, a lot is known by mathematicians. There are whole books on the properties of the Gaussian free field, but it's studied since decades. But so basically you should not view it as a function, but as a random wild distribution, okay? Okay, so now let me try to get out of this and go back to Zoom. Okay, so here I'm back. I managed to do it. And I still have just 7 minutes. So let me just show that this feature, it's not a problem of quantum field theory. This feature of quantum field theory that the fields are singular at short distance is not really a problem, but it's a feature that one can use to study quantum field theory. And I will just have time to discuss very briefly the case. Well, I just stated above that the expectation value of phi squared is infinite. So it looks like constructing an operator which is phi of x squared, this is a not well-defined object. Okay, actually, this naive products, so defining phi squared of x as phi of x times phi of x, indeed, this is a problem. Okay, but you can define an object which corresponds to what you have probably seen in the canonical formalism, which is called the direct products of operator. So you can define an object which is called the composite operator, which is called the normal product. Is called the normal product operator, which is a product of phi and phi. Okay. And let's see, how can you define this? I'm going to define an object which is called the soul. I use the standard notation, it's phi squared of x with two dots, okay? Let's define this just as the limit when you have two points, x1, which goes to x, let's say. So you have x and y going to, or if you prefer, x1 and x2 goes to x of the operator phi of x1. The operator phi of x2, and I'm going to subtract to this object, which is singular when x1 and x2 goes towards the same points. I'm going to subtract the expectation value in the vacuum of phi of x1, phi of x2, times an operator, which is the identity operator located at x, so it's just the identity operator. The identity operator is just defined by the trivial property that when you have, you compute an expectation value of phi of, let's say, x1, phi of xn, you had the identity operator at the another point for any expectation value of these products of operator computed in the functional interval. This is by definition equal to phi of x1, phi of xn. Okay. So this is just the corresponding concept in terms of operator in quantum field theory, of the identity operator acting on some Hilbert space. So it's the operator, which is a diagonal operator, which you apply to any, you multiply it to any operator, or you apply it to any vector in the Hilbert space, and you get the vector, the corresponding operator, or you can get the corresponding vector in the Hilbert space. So it's just the identity operator. Okay, so now you see, this is object, this is an object, and it's easy to show that this object, this limit exists in the limit exists and is a well-defined operator. So this is a well-defined operator. Operator. Which is of course located, so it supports at the point x. So we started from two operators located at two points. We let the two points tend together to a given point x. We subtract the dangerous different part, which is infinite, and we get something which is finite. Okay. So this is a sketchy way to construct a well-defined operator located at a point x, which has a finite distance in the sense that when you compute the expectation value of phi of xn, and you had the products of this phi, this normal order operator phi squared of xn plus one, and take the vacuum expectation value of this object, this exists. So this has no ultraviolet singularities in the quantum theory. Okay, so this is a receipt. I finished my time. And to show that this object this new operator, which is a normal product of the two operator of phi located at the same point x, to show that this object makes sense and in the free field quantum field theory, requires the use just of Wick's theorem. And I have not discussed yet Wick's theorem in the framework of the functional integral formalism for quantization, for quantizing quantum field theory. But Wick's theorem is valid in functional integral approach of quantum field theory, because the correlation function are the same than the one we obtained by canonical formalism, by the canonical quantization formalism. And I'm going to discuss a bit Wick's theorem next lecture, so next Monday, before going to the discussing how you construct an interacting quantum field theory within the functional integral formalism, which is basically something parallel to what you have seen in QFT1 and QFT2. So I'm going to discuss Wick's theorem and the beginning of constructing of interacting field theory next week. I'm okay? I'm in time.
Just one question.
Yes.
In somewhere in between in the lectures, you mentioned that when we in the Minkowski space, when we look at the space-time interval, the propagator would be the same as the Euclidean propagator.
No, it's the Feynman propagator is analytic continuation of the Euclidean propagator. So if you consider them as an object, as a function defined both, you know, in the complex,
complex.
Consider that, for instance, you start from Euclidean space-time and you complexified time, but you may also complexify the order space coordinates. You can play with two times and d minus two space, but that's much less interesting and you run quickly into a problem. But you may start from Euclidean space-time and complexify all space and time coordinates, or you may start from Minkowski space-time and complexify all the time and space coordinates. Then it turns out that the correlation function of the theory have some very precise and well-defined analyticity property in this complexified larger space-time.
Okay. Yeah, so and my question
and
was,
so that in this way they are, you know, just section of the same mathematical object, which is some complex function of complex space-time coordinates. But those functions in this much bigger, you know, twice larger space, those functions are analytic in some part, in some domain, and have singularities and discontinuities on some region. It's convenient to consider them as just some function on this generalized space of complexified space-time. Yes. So for a mathematician, it makes sense to say those are the same function. For a physicist, of course, if you restrict yourself in some section, real sections of complex space-time, one section is Euclidean space-time, one section is Minkowski space-time, the value of this complex function is different on the section.
So, but the value on the Minkowski section in the space-like interval is zero, right? I mean, that's what I wanted to confirm, because we learned in canonical in the other QFT courses that
not,
the propagators on space-like separated points vanish.
No, well, it depends. The Feynman propagator is not zero on space-time, but the advanced and the retard propagator are zero. But they are zero because I have stated very quickly, well, briefly here without any proof, the retard and the advanced propagator are obtained by taking the difference between the difference between Feynman propagators, you know, continued in different ways. So for instance, in fact, what you can show is that if you have this picture of this continuity, that the advanced propagator is the difference between, so this is a Feynman. This is Feynman. Because Feynman is the Euclidean propagator Vic-rotated. Mm-hmm. So Feynman propagator is the value of the analytically continued Euclidean propagator above the past light cone, but below
the future light cone.
The future light cone in this picture. But in fact, since this is Euclidean space-time, you should invert anyway. But now with the same picture, it's an exercise. You have to be careful. You can show that the retard propagator is, well, the advanced propagator is this, which is the Gaussian, which is the Feynman propagator. So you get plus with this, minus this. So it's the difference between two different analytic continuation of the Euclidean propagator in Minkowski spacetime. And this particular difference, you see that here, this is the same function, so the difference is zero. While here, this is the difference between below and above the cut, so this is different from zero. So you check that the advanced propagator is non-zero in the future, but is zero in the past. And with a bit of work, you can check that it's also zero in the space-like region of Minkowski space-time. So you make this game of mathematical games, you be careful, you check what you have, and you get all the correct causal properties for the different propagator you can define, working carefully and keeping track of how you define your propagator on the Minkowski spacetime by deformation of the propagator in Euclidean spacetime. Okay.
Thank
you. I don't have some type note of that, but I checked that yesterday. So I have some paper notes. I might type them, but I'm sure you can find that in some textbook.
Thank you.
Okay.
We're going to do Wick's theorem, as you said, but could you just briefly say how time ordering shows up in this? Because if I recall correctly, before when we talked about Wick's theorem, you know, this involved time ordering, but this correlation function does not.
Okay, well, Wick's theorem involves, the proof of Wick's theorem involves time ordering, which involves the fact that the operator in canonical quantization do not commute. And in the functional integral formalism, you don't need that, because basically in the functional integral formalism, it's like in the path integral formalism, the operators are automatically ordered, time ordered in the functional integral. So Wick's theorem comes out from something much more simple, which is the properties of the Gaussian integrals. So I showed you yesterday how just using the simplest property of the Gaussian integral, which is basically that, if you use the language of probability, it means that the variance of the Gaussian, it means that the correlation function of the two-point correlation function of a Gaussian random variable is the inverse of the variance of this Gaussian integral. Remember, a Gaussian integral is something, a Gaussian variable is something, so you have a vector x, which is, well, let me call it not x, but phi. Phi, which is a collection of phi a equal 1 to n. So that's the n-dimensional Gaussian variable. And the probability, the weight for phi is proportional to, so it's an unnormalized weight. It's exponential of minus 1 half of phi a, phi b, some matrix KAB. Okay. So basically, I think, well, I'm not confusing that. No, so phi I, phi B is a correlation. And I just have to check whether this is called the variance. Well, I have to check in. I'm sorry. At the moment, I've forgotten my basics of probability, so I have to check in the Facebook what is the variance of the.
The variance would probably be then the.
What?
I think the variance should probably be the square minus the other square. No?
Square.
But, yeah, we can.
Well, this is some. Where do you see square?
No, here I don't see a square. Never mind.
Okay, yeah, so basically, when you compute the expectation value of that, so in the language of probabilities, that's called the expectation of phi AB. In the language of phi, if you look some in probability, this is called the expectation value of the random variable. Phi B, and in the language of statistical mechanics or physics, it's called the expectation value is denoted by brackets. This is just inverse matrix KAB. So this has some name. So this is the expectation value, and then I think K is a variance, but I have just to check in my textbook. Anyway, this basic theorem of Gaussian random fiber is all what you need to derive the propagator in the Gaussian free field. And there is a more general theorem for Gaussian probability, which states that the expectation value of ID is just the sum over pairs of the expectation value of phi phi. So you take the pairings between A, B, C, D, or here for four of them. You have three pairings. These are the matrix K. So this is the mathematical version of Vick's theorem using the language of probability theory. So that's what I'm going to discuss on Monday. And well, if I walked a bit and if I have time, I can provide you with, for those of you who are not familiar with probability theory, I can provide you a simple proof of this result. Using something which is important in quantum field theory and also in many area of physics, which is called the theory of generating functional of correlation function. So what I'm going to speak tomorrow, maybe tomorrow or on maybe on Friday, maybe on Thursday. But I'll try to do that on Monday. I'm going to discuss the theory of generating functional. which in mathematics, in priority theory, is called the theory of it's not extreme events, but well, there is a terminology for that. It's Friday evening, so large deviation, yes. Large period. This is physics. This is math. Language for the same object. Which allows to compute in a very compact way this kind of object, or in a quantum field theory, these correlation functions. Okay. Okay. I think I have to leave now because I have to do some shopping before going home. For me, it's a 6:45. But have a nice weekend and see you on Monday.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.